It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3444. Thank you. 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner, chief veterinarian at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning.
Oh, I found my glasses.
You're going to the dogs this morning.
We go to the dogs for your show. And now we go to the professional. Tom and Caitlin in Hudson. Recently, we noticed that one of our cat's third eyelids is showing. It doesn't look bad. I mean, it's not red or discharging anything, but we can see it, which is new. Is this a problem? I should say our cat is pretty old, 11, and goes outside sometimes. He is a neutered male.
The third eyelid is just like it sounds. It is a lid that comes from the corner, from the inside corner of the eye, called the nictitating membrane, and it can come all the way up and cover the eye. It's an additional lid for protection, but it's not under conscious control. So when the third eyelid is sticking up, it usually means that there's a problem of some kind. If it doesn't have to be red in order for there to be something like an ulcer, an injury to the cornea. The cornea is a clear layer on top of the surface of the eye, has several layers actually to it. But it's possible that there, even without a red third eyelid or swollen third eyelid, that there is a problem with the cornea underneath. Usually, if the cornea is irritated, we all know how painful that can be with our own eyes, then you see signs of pain as well. So squinting, tearing in the corner of the eye. The other thing that comes to mind with one third eyelid up, so there can be an issue with two of them being raised, which is called Hawes syndrome, and that's kind of poorly understood, so I won't go into that. But when you have one of them up, it's more likely a problem, either with the eye, or it can be Horner's syndrome. That is one of the first things that comes to mind, and Horner's syndrome is really just describing dysfunction of the sympathetic nerves that go to the eye. So it causes three symptoms, and one of them is called enophthalmos, and that means that the eye is sort of sunken into the socket. And when the eye sinks into the socket, then the third eyelid automatically comes up. So that could be it. You would also see with Horner's, and people may have heard of this because some people get it, I think, with Lyme disease and facial palsy and Horner syndrome. And the upper lid droops. It's called ptosis, and meiosis is the third symptom, and that means the pupil is small. So you can look for those things. So three things. Third eyelid would be up. The pupil would be pretty small compared to the other side and not so responsive to being in the dark. You know how our pupils should not constrict, should open up when we're in the dark. So the third thing would be the droop of the upper eyelid. So if you stand back and look at your kitty and compare the eyes, you might be able to tell that. It can be subtle. So this is a problem that should be seen by a veterinarian, especially...
After all that.
Well, I thought it would be interesting, too.
It is, because what you're reminding me of is that we had this with Mr. Mars Black many, many, many years ago, which is where it did. And I only realized that when you mentioned the name of the syndrome, which I was trying to figure out. But it's pretty disconcerting. It's weird, is what it is.
It is. It's really interesting to me because it shows you the interesting innervation to the third eyelid from the sympathetic nervous system. And that is, your sympathetics are sort of responsible for your fight or flight response. And so there can be damage to that. And the damage can be anywhere along the side of the face, can be also a... inner ear problem, a middle ear or inner ear problem, because some of those nerves run right across that section of the face. The third eyelid being up can also be a function of facial nerve paralysis. So if the facial nerve is damaged, that's running across the side of the face, or there's maybe a tumor, maybe an abscess inside of a tooth, that kind of thing, although that's less likely.
Is there an idiopathic, and I just remember in Mr. Black's case, there was some sort of just random, oh yes, you go through all of this, and then it's like, oh yeah, and also it just happens.
Most commonly in animals, Horner syndrome is idiopathic, and it does go away with time, so it usually resolves with time. I don't know how it is with people, but with animals, it usually resolves with time. Sometimes it can leave a lingering, droopy eyelid.
Right, for a bit.
Yeah.
Forever. But after we get out of the lesson part of this, they're going to have to. The cat should be looked at by a vet, right?
Yes, because if you catch, if you've got a tumor there or a middle ear infection, you want to be able to catch that and treat it and have all of the symptoms go away with time.
All right. Thank you. All right, Sarah, in New Preston, I just got my first pet rat. Just got my first pet rat. You can see how I feel about this. And I, Sarah, is totally in love. Charm is an absolute angel, and I want her to have the longest, healthiest possible life. So we have to hope she doesn't have a snake. Can you please tell me, is she likely to have better longevity if she has a rat friend? And also, can you tell me if there's a more whole foods-oriented diet for rats rather than just commercially sold pellets?
So it sounds, Jill, like you have an aversion to rats.
Rodents, period.
To rodents, period.
Yeah.
Rats are
sweet.
Can make really nice pets.
People love rats. In fairness,
And they can be very bonded to people. So if you have a lot of time and your rat is and you work at home and your rat's with you all the time, you don't necessarily need to have a rat friend. But they are very social creatures. So if you're going to leave your rat in a cage for much of the day, then having another rat is a good idea.
Can a rat have the run of the house?
I don't know that I would allow that.
Okay.
You're going to find rat pellets all over the place, but I imagine some people do, depending on the size of the house.
And the size of the rat.
Or maybe the run of a room.
How big do the rats get?
They can get pretty large. They can get to be, with the tail, of course, but without the tail, they can get to be, almost probably 8 inches, 10 inches.
Size?
Not that big. No, I don't think so. In your nightmares, they do.
Yes, no, definitely, and they have teeth in my nightmares and on the subway. But
And so having a friend. Go ahead. You have a question.
Yeah, I was wondering how long is the average rat life?
I couldn't tell you for sure. I'm thinking I've probably seen them. So I think it depends on whether you have a white rat that's a laboratory rat that I don't. That may not live as long, and they have all kinds of different strains. So it can vary, but I'm saying around, once your rat gets to be 6 or 7 years old, you have some age. So I'm thinking around 8 years old would be average.
Oh, okay.
So
you can get pretty bonded.
You can get pretty bonded, but the disclaimer here is that I am not a specialist. I'm not a specialist in exotic animals, right? So I'm telling you what I know from treating these animals here and there. And the question about the diet is, of course, with any animal across the board, to have a more whole foods diet is better. The problem being is that it's very difficult. I think it would be difficult to be certain that your pet is getting all of the nutrients that it needs. So the most important thing, I think, is to get a fresh rat pellet. So what they do is they, put in all of the nutrients that are needed and compress it into a pellet. So it's not going to be fresh food, but it is going to be a complete and balanced diet. So I would say probably 50% get a fresh pellet. And that means you have to buy it from a place that is turning it over. So you don't want to get that at Stop and Shop. It could have been sitting there for 2 years on the shelf.
So you'd go to, for example, the Feed Barn or something like
Yes, go to a feed store or maybe even get them directly from the manufacturer.
Okay.
50% of the diet could be that, and then fresh whole foods for any living creature is the best way to supplement and try to feed a fresh diet and a species-appropriate diet. And what I would recommend is some research on that. So there, I know that there's a list of foods that rats can't have. They're mostly raw type things, so raw sweet potatoes. There are certain chemicals in some of the raw foods that they can't have. But there are lots and lots of fruits and vegetables that they can have, and and liver. So you're not going to probably get all the great things from liver when it's dried and put into a pellet. So a little bit of liver supplement, some apples and bananas and berries and
sounds like what a lot of people that I know eat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so you can share your food, but absolutely do your research. I'm not an expert. There's lots of information out there, so you have to sort it through. So you need to get your research done from probably an association who deals in rats or an exotic animal website. I would be very careful where to find that.
Yeah, and this is where I would just say as a cautionary measure, you probably don't want to just use the internet. You might want to make some phone calls.
Right, because there's information out there. For instance, I have seen diets for exotic animals. You can make your own diet, and then you look at the ingredients, and it has things like breakfast cereal and macaroni. So, you know, you're getting all these nutrients, but you might as well just get a pellet because it's all processed food anyway.
Right.
And the pellet is directed toward your species. So be careful what you see. Look for fresh whole foods that we would eat and that they're allowed to eat.
Right. And I will just also say, as someone who's been doing this for quite a while, unless you keep up on everything, it really helps to deal with someone who knows what they're talking about, because the level of assumption and departure can be very high. You know, you think you're doing a great thing.
Fake news.
I go back to the cat again with the string beans. Like, who would think that unlimited string beans would be bad for a cat?
And cause urinary crystals, was that the problem?
I think whatever.
Yeah, changing the pH.
This pH was so hot. You said presciently this cat has the pH of a racehorse, but it was, and that's the point. You know, you think that you can call it fake news, or you can say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But you know, who would have thought that green beans would be, you know, something yummy would be problematic, and
that's
the real trick to all of this.
Something that we think of as healthy, such as grapes feeding to dogs, is a no-no.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
All right, Josh in Albany, this is a quickie because it is not your specialité, but are there diseases that can be passed between reptiles and birds? I just want to read the question. I have an African gray parrot, and I'm thinking about moving into a roommate situation where the other guy has two bearded dragons and an iguana.
That sounds like an interesting apartment.
That is. I was just thinking that. Like, that's a pretty cool mix.
Yeah.
What do these guys do as a? I was just wondering. Like, are these good pets?
Yeah, I mean, African gray parrots are absolutely lovely. It's just it's a matter of whether they were hand raised or wild caught, and a wild caught parrot is usually pretty unhappy its whole life. But a hand raised baby can be too if it doesn't get enough attention. So if you're hand feeding an African gray parrot, and then not paying enough attention or having someone home with it, then you have and locking it in a cage, then you, without enough toys and without enough interesting foods, then you potentially have a parrot who will have no feathers. They pick their feathers because they're anxious all the time. So it can be a very sad situation. And those birds are rehomed and rehomed and rehomed because, you know, everybody wants one, but they don't have enough time for them, really, which is time means, you know, being home with them, working from home,
right,
and being able to tolerate the noise in the background. So it's, so they're...
And that's, you actually raise a really excellent point, because this is a question I was going to ask you anyway, speaking of prescience, people don't really, you cannot get from watching on TV the amount of time that it actually takes to get that pet, whatever he, she, or it may be, to look as responsive and easygoing and fun and cuddly as seen on TV.
Right. It's very difficult in our culture to give them everything that they need, and they really belong, you know, they really belong in the wild. So to have them as a pet, they need a lot, and I've always wanted one, but I've never had one because I know that I wouldn't be able to give it the time, you know, or whatever.
Well, you
could
take it to your practice, and that would be interesting. I totally know one of your clients who had a bird who, you know, couldn't get off Martha's Vineyard, I believe, because the bird whose wings were clipped had flown away.
Oh,
so
yeah,
no. And by the way, bird was recovered. It has a happy ending.
Oh, good.
But, no,
good end to that story.
Totally happy ending. I only tell happy. I try to tell happy ending stories. But the point is that this whimsical and on a whim, she loved this creature, but her kids were just ready to commit her and have the creature, you know, freed. Let's just say. Went on for 6 years.
Yeah. Getting back to the question, I guess what I would say is that many people will have reptiles and birds living together, and that I do know that reptiles and birds will both carry similar zoonotic diseases. So there's things like salmonella that people can potentially get. What I don't know is whether reptiles pass those things to birds and birds pass those things to reptiles if they have carried different species of those things like chlamydia and salmonella, because I am not an expert, as I say. So there we go again. So I would say to pass that along to someone who is a veterinarian who is an exotic animal expert and get your answer. But so, you know, do you have to protect your parrot from certain things, or just simply make sure that the veterinarian that the bearded dragons go to and the iguana has been, you know, updated by the person you're moving in with, and ask that veterinarian or your own who treats your bird, you know, is there anything that we need to be concerned about health-wise? But I don't know the answer to that.
All right. And how does one find a reputable specialist? And I know that sounds oxymoronic because I guess the first thing to do would be Google, but here you go again.
Well, or you can go on the AVMA website.
Okay.
Yeah, the American Veterinary Medical Association, and find an exotic animal veterinarian.
All right. So the long short is that you go to the website aggregate of the association, for example, and they because you can't just get any old person cannot just get on that, correct?
Right. Well, you would be a member of the AVMA. Veterinarians would be. Now, that is voluntary. Most veterinarians I know are members. And then you put in what your specialties are. And most vets don't want to see those animals a lot if they, for instance, I would not put myself in, even though I do see rabbits. I see rabbits a lot. And I see some guinea pigs, and occasionally I'll see birds, but I don't put myself in as a specialist because it is very, very challenging if you can't keep up on the information. You know, 25 years ago, I used to treat everything, but there's no way to keep up on all the information on all the pets.
Right.
Because it moves so fast now.
And that's, okay, so AVMA website or similar.
Right.
All right. Harriet in Bristol, one of my beloved neighbors recently passed away. Before she died, I agreed to take on the care of her puppy, Joey Bacon. Yes, really. Joey Bacon is a mix of King Charles Cavalier Spaniel and Burmese Mountain Dog. Okay,
so how does that work?
Exactly. Okay, so besides the sheer freakiness of this mix, and how did they do it? My understanding is that King Charles dogs are extremely likely to have congenital heart ailments. And Bernese Mountain Dogs are so big, I can't imagine they don't also have heart issues. So do I have a dog with a very imminent expiration date? What should I keep an eye out for? How can I ensure heart health? Or am I just being a doggy hypochondriac?
So I'd be interested to know if this dog truly is a cross of those two breeds. That's kind of interesting. Or is it just Are they just breeds that are coming up in the DNA evaluation, perhaps? I can't even imagine what one would look like. These are very distinctive breeds. The Bernese is a very large dog. The Cavalier is a pretty small dog who has a very round head and just adorable. Huge eyes that are endearing. Yeah. And the Bernese has such a wonderful personality. But they live to be, you know, their average age is 6 to 9 years old, the Bernese. And they carry with them a lot of the genetic predisposition to many diseases, such as hip dysplasia. Cavaliers are also genetically predisposed to hip dysplasia. So that would be one thing I would watch for. The heart issue, more in the Cavalier than the Bernese, but Bernese can also have heart disease. So we're looking at, for the Bernese Mountain Dog, off the top of my head, hip dysplasia, elbow dysplasia, cataracts, entropion, which is where the lower eyelids roll in. And they also get progressive retinal atrophy, which can cause blindness. They have skin allergies. They're predisposed also to cancers, mast cell tumors, histiocytosis, lymphosarcoma, just off the top of my head. So many, many, many predispositions to diseases that are not good, and I think that's why their lifespan's so short. Lots and lots of allergies. Probably add even kidney disease to that list. And then the Cavalier, mostly, I think, in my memory, a couple of things, and that would be they get this problem with the spinal cord and brain called syringomyelia, and I'm not sure that it's known exactly what causes it, but I think it's a malformation in the spinal cord way up in the neck where it attaches to the head. And so it can cause all kinds of neurologic problems there. But I think for the mix of these two dogs, hip dysplasia would be on the top of the list, and heart disease. So the great news here is that if you have a cross, then you have a much less chance of the expression of these genes, because you usually don't have, you know, you need pairings of the genes in most instances. So they can be, your dog could be carrier of all these things, but potentially never express any of these things. So that is the great news. And the bad news is that you have to watch for all kinds of things. I would definitely think about, so I'm interested to know how big this dog is. And, you know, if you've got, the bigger the dog, the more problematic hip dysplasia can be. So watch for signs of poor movement and pain in the joints, but also make sure that you keep your dog very slim. So that's
and
a great idea.
What about diet?
So the diet would be, you know, as much of a species-appropriate natural diet as possible. So what my opinion is, and it's not just my opinion, is that if you feed an animal a species-appropriate diet, meaning, you know, enough protein for a dog, enough animal protein, not necessarily from plant products, and you feed them a well-balanced diet and a good variety, then you can delay the expression or even prevent the expression of some bad genes. So you want to go with a really good diet with this puppy. And I don't remember if it sounds like this person has, Harriet has another dog or not. I can't remember. It was a long question.
It doesn't look like it.
Yeah, so with one dog, it can be easier to feed. You know, it can get expensive to feed whole foods to your dog. But we're talking about potentially a raw food diet with some supplementing of fresh fruits and vegetables. But that would be a whole other discussion, which we've had before on this show.
Okay. Should I go with the other question? We've got 2 minutes. I can. Carl in Pittsfield. Me and my wife are confused about cedar shavings. Our kids have guinea pigs, and we've been using cedar shavings for the cages. Then someone told my wife cedar is toxic. Googling it seems like you're not supposed to put them in the cages of bunnies, hamsters, etc. either. If they're so toxic, though, why do all the pet shops sell them? Good question, Carl.
That is a good question, and I think we've talked about cedar shavings on this show before. The Django agrees.
I was just going to say, I just didn't know who agreed. Okay.
What my understanding is that it's been discovered in laboratory animals that their liver enzyme, they get liver enzyme elevations when they're on cedar bedding. And that's maybe not just cedar, it might be pine as well. And so I'm not sure that there haven't been, to my knowledge, any symptoms associated with it. But when the liver enzymes are elevated, then that can mean inflammation in the body, inflammation in the liver, potentially a toxicity of some kind. I don't, in my research anyway, that or just readings that I've done, I don't believe that there's been something definitive that's been discovered that's toxic. I could be wrong. It should be probably something that I researched since now it's come up twice on the show. But my understanding is that the reason they're able to be sold is because nobody's seen an adverse effect.
Okay.
So we know that the liver enzymes are elevated. We don't see the animals get sick. But in my mind, I wouldn't want my pet on something that causes a change in liver enzymes. Okay? Mm-hmm. So they can be sold. I would avoid them. I think it's best to avoid them. There are lots of other products out there. There are the byproducts of grain whatever they do with grains, you know, the hulls and so forth. There are that can be used for either cat litter or bedding for these guys. Wood pulp, different kinds of wood pulp, pellets that are made from paper-based products. So you have choices.
So you've got enough options that you could
I think aspen shavings are good as well.
All right.
I would stay away. Let me just throw in there. I would stay away from black walnut only because I know it causes problems with horses.
And cherry.
Right. All right. Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cannon.
That was a stretch.
Yeah, very good job, though. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.